Welcome. You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for Colorado Gardener, read by Christy McGowan, featuring articles from Green Prints and Colorado Gardener. The Year of Too Many Pumpkins, Chasing the Perfect Pie and Finding Meaning in the Mess Instead, by Christy Page. And this is from Green Prints, November 2025 edition. There are several things that signal autumn to me. Colorful leaves tumbling down, brisk mornings that nip at your cheeks, fresh apples in every market, and pumpkins stacked high. As soon as autumn arrives, so does my urge to fire up the stove. Baking warms the house and our hearts along with our tummies. When it comes to autumn baking, apples usually take first place, but pumpkins run a very close second. Pumpkin pie, pumpkin bread, and especially pumpkin whoopie pies, filled with my mom's special fluff-based filling, those are the tastes that bring the season home to me. Most years, I take the easy route with canned pumpkin. But one autumn, I decided to be brave and try fresh pumpkins instead. It began simply enough, a drive down a back road where I came upon a farm stand overflowing with pumpkins. The farmer told me they hadn't been given the attention they deserved that year. Good in size, but not the perfect shapes people usually want. To me, though, they looked wonderful. When he offered them at a bargain price, I couldn't resist. I filled my car to the brim and drove home with 15 pumpkins, giddy at the thought of what I might create. My family thought I had finally lost my mind. We set aside a few for decoration, but what about the rest? I insisted they'd all find their way into our kitchen. That Saturday became a blur of pumpkin prep. Washing, slicing, peeling, seeding, steaming. My counters filled with bright orange flesh. My freezer with containers of puree. It was far more work than I expected, but in my head I could already see the perfect pumpkin pies gracing our holiday table. By the end, though, I was weary. The last few pumpkins were simply roasted in chunks and served with meals, a humble but delicious reward for my effort. The next afternoon came my big test, my first pie made with fresh pumpkin. The aroma filled the house, cinnamon, nutmeg, and anticipation. Waiting for it to cool was nearly unbearable. Finally, after dinner, we each took a slice. My husband tried the first bite as I leaned forward, eager for his verdict. He chewed, then shrugged. "Tastes the same as it usually does," he said. My heart fell a little. All that work, all those hours, and in the end, the taste was no different than the canned version. Still, that autumn and winter, every container of pumpkin I pulled from the freezer carried with it the memory of that day, the long hours, the laughter, the stubborn determination to wring every ounce of autumn out of those pumpkins. The flavor may have been the same, but the experience was not. Since then, I've returned to canned pumpkin. It's easier, and life is busy. But I still hold on to that season, and the lesson it gave me. Sometimes the value isn't in the final bite, but in the journey, the memory, and the love that goes into it. Maybe next year, if my pumpkin patch thrives, I'll try again. Because part of me still longs for that perfect pie. Not in taste, but in story. How to Get Indoor Cactus to Bloom by Kelly Grummins. And this is from Colorado Gardener. Question. Over the last few years, I've collected a number of cacti and succulents. When I look them up online, it shows that they have gorgeous flowers. Mine never bloom. I have them in various windowsills and on tables near the window. Do they have to be older to flower? Do they need a certain kind of fertilizer? Answer. I'm amazed how popular cacti and succulents have become. The species I see are easy for the production nursery to grow. Echeveria, sedum, mammillaria, crassula, etc. But are not necessarily the best for windowsill culture. These also are not known for their beautiful flowers. Now, most of the cacti we grow indoors come from Central America. They may be from desert or mountainous areas, but most species live in regions that are hot during the day and quite chilly at night. This temperature fluctuation is often necessary for stimulating cacti to produce flowers. Think about it. Most homes stay at a similar temperature day and night. To stimulate flowers, look for a cooler room, like a guest bedroom, to keep the plants in, at least during the winter months. Shut off the heat register and give them as much light as possible. Temperatures between 45 and 55 degrees will stimulate flowers in most species. If you don't have such a room, there's an alternative plan. Move your cacti and succulents outdoors in early June and leave them outside until light frosts begin in September or October. The natural temperatures in our region can fluctuate 20 to 30 degrees from day to night. This will certainly help with the flowering process. Very little fertilizer is needed for cacti, but it can be helpful in their overall health. Find a fertilizer that is particularly designed for cacti. These often contain calcium nitrate. Or use fertilizers from the sea, such as kelp or fish emulsion, with more natural calcium. Apply fertilizers only while the plants are in their active growth phase, which is usually from March through September. Less is more. In general, let cacti and succulents dry thoroughly between waterings. Also, water much less while they are cool in the winter months. Thanksgiving, the Gardener's Holiday by Pat Stone. And this is from Green Prints, November 2025 edition. I've always had a special affection for Thanksgiving. It seems to me the gentlest, the kindest of our holidays. There are no glaring red rockets or blowouts on beer. There's not the commercialization of Christmas, when a blizzard of promotion buries the holiday's original purpose. It hasn't been gimmicked up with brash hats and colored eggs like Easter. Thanksgiving remains true to the words in its name. Thanksgiving is, in essence, a tribute to gardening. True, the hunter's booty gets top billing, but the accompaniments, corn, rice, squash, pumpkins, the provisions that will sustain the pilgrims through the cold months ahead, these come from growers who, for months just over, cared for their crops. Hence, Thanksgiving reminds us that whether we live in a Manhattan high-rise or Vancouver houseboat, it is plants on which we depend. Oh, sure. Today, you can zip down to the local Safeway and pick up a fresh New Zealand apple or Mexican strawberry. Foods that seem to have originated plastic-wrapped on a shelf. But we don't eat them on Thanksgiving. We eat the foods people grow and store right here. Provisions that declare their roots and our ties to them. Foods that talk to us. Crops you grow and sustain, they say, are what grow and sustain you. Thanksgiving also reminds us that as plants give to us, so should we give to each other. For it was the generosity of the original Americans to some uninvited newcomers that created that first November feast. Cultivate each other, the meal reminds us. Give each other the gift of your food, of yourselves. What quiet, special lessons those are. With heads bowed and hands clasped, give thanks for fruits, friends, family. Then, like the plants and the gardeners who grew them, share. Under the willow tree, the tree of love, secrets, and death. By Diana Wells. And this is from Greenprints, November 2025 edition. She was the most ornery, irritating dog that ever was. She looked like a cross that no breeder ever could have achieved, between a favorite toy and a jackal. She had very large ears, and someone, before we got her, had named her Rabbit. She didn't look like a rabbit, but the name stuck. If there was a foul-smelling carcass anywhere within miles, she would find it, roll in it, and come home with that slightly ashamed, slightly triumphant look of a woman returning from the beauty parlor with a new hairstyle. She would then be bathed or banished, according to the weather. If we called her to be bathed, she would lie down and slither on her stomach as if her legs were paralyzed. When released, clean and fluffy as a Christmas toy, she would immediately head for the smell again. Usually, we gave up and let her stay outside for a few days until it wore away. Rabbit used to lie under the weeping willow by the pond and wait for frogs or garter snakes, which she caught with phenomenal skill. Then she would leave them until they were properly ripe, unless we could find the carcass in time and throw it into the bramble thicket. They smelled the best of all, and usually she had to camp out for a week after one of those. Not that she minded. She really preferred her doghouse, and we would have left her outside all the time, except that she drove us crazy barking on moonlit nights. When we did keep her in, she often messed in the kitchen. We suspected she did it on purpose, because she certainly didn't lack intelligence. I knew why she had been taken to the dog pound, where we got her, and she knew I would never take her back there. The weeping willow where she caught frogs had fronds reaching to the water, forming a thick green tent beside the pond. The children played forts and houses under it when they were teenagers. Willows have always lent themselves to secret occupations. Down in the willow garden where my love and I did meet. Because so many lovers used the fronds as friendly hiding places, willows came to be associated with love itself, especially jilted love. In love the sad forsake wight, the willow garden weareth, as Shakespeare said. Jilted love and illicit love sometimes lead to awkward situations, and awkward situations, as we know, sometimes lead to crime. That same willow garden was where I had a bottle of burgundy wine, which my true love did not know, and there I poisoned that dear little girl, down under the bank below. Unless she was quick enough to save herself. Then he turned his back around and faced yon willow tree. She caught him around the middle so small and throwed him into the sea. As well as stalking frogs, Rabbit hid under the willow tree to eat eggs. She stole the hen's eggs with amazing cunning and intelligence. It took us weeks to figure out why the hens had stopped laying as she grew fatter and glossier each day. By the time we caught her, red pawed, she had learned to balance an egg, bite its top neatly off, and lick out the inside without spilling. That finally explained the puzzling, almost intact eggshells we had found under the tree. Willows are of the Salix family. Their flexible branches have been used from ancient times for basket weaving and even for buckets, because they expand when wet. In Ireland, baskets for peat and other uses were woven at home from a grove of willows by the house, called a Sally Garden, from the name Salix. Here it was that the poet Yeats's lover passed the Sally Gardens with little snow-white feet. Weeping willow trees were named Salix Babylonica because they were thought to have originated from beside the rivers of Babylon, where the exiled Jews wept when we remembered Zion. We hanged our harps upon the willows in the midst thereof. Psalm 137. It was thought that the weight of the hanging harps had pulled down the willow branches, which remained pendant ever since. Actually, the tree probably originated in China. It was introduced to England in the 18th century, along with other chinoiserie, including the first willow pattern plates made then, which, not surprisingly, show lovers eloping over a bridge under a willow tree, chased by an irate father. The lovers are also shown as two doves in the sky, which implies that all did not go well with them. If they died, a willow tree was appropriate too, for from ancient times it was associated with death. A willow garland was found in the tomb of Tutankhamun. The willow, unlike the cypress, also a tree of death, will regenerate itself if cut, so it was a more optimistic symbol. It also has healing powers. Its bark contains salicin, which is an ingredient of aspirin. However, the name aspirin is coined from acetylsalicylic acid and spirea, a meadow sweet that also contains salicin. The ancients thought the trees grew in wet places to provide a cure for gout and rheumatism. The theory being that those ailments were associated with dampness, and that God provided a very convenient cure for every ill. Weeping willows were used a great deal by Victorians in the 19th century, both as graveyard trees and carved on tombstones. Andrew Downing recommended planting willows, since their light and elegant foliage flowed like the disheveled hair and graceful drapery of a sculptured mourner over a sepulchral urn. He added that the tree conveys those soothing, those softly melancholy reflections which have made one of our poets exclaim, "There is a pleasure even in grief." One morning we couldn't find Rabbit. We searched for her and finally found her lying in the doghouse. No guilty look, no tail wagging. She didn't even smell. She just lay there. I took her to the vet, and after examining her, he gently said that there was nothing he could do. She was dying. We could have her put down or brought her home. She was not in pain, so I decided to bring her home. We put her back where she had chosen to be, in the doghouse. She lay there for a week. Each morning we expected to find her dead. Sometimes she would wag her tail a little. Sometimes her ears would prick when we whispered her name. She would not look at food or water. We thought of moving her or taking her back to the vet, but there was something about the way she looked at us that made us leave her there. Then we had snow. We covered the whole doghouse in thick tarpaulins to keep the cold out. She wagged her tail a bit when we tucked her in. We even had a little hope that night that she might recover. The next morning, she looked a little better. It was snowing heavily. Then, at lunchtime, she was gone. We didn't believe it. We felt sure she wasn't strong enough to walk. We searched for her all day, calling her, looking for footprints in the fast-falling snow, poking into briar patches hung with icicles, tangling our coats and hair in the thick brush. We didn't find her. She had not intended that we should. It was not until spring, after the snow had melted, that we found her body under the willow tree. Of course, we buried her there. The new leaves of the willow formed a bright green tent around us as we dug. The season of sleep was over, and the trees knew exactly what to do. Just as in autumn, they would know to shed their leaves. Just as she, whom we had laughed at, raved at, and loved, had known exactly, when the time came, what to do. Q&A by Keith Funk, and this is from Colorado Gardener. Question. Some of the tropical plants I brought into the house to spend the winter are dropping leaves. What's going on? Answer. It's not unusual for plants to re-acclimate to indoor conditions when you bring them inside. Light levels are lower indoors, and the air is drier. Give them time to adjust to their new conditions. Be sure to continue to feed them at least monthly through the winter to keep them as healthy as possible. If they grew enough during the summer to need potting up into larger pots, this is a fine time to do that, using a good quality potting soil and a pot that is only 2 to 3 inches bigger in diameter. Don't overpot. Adjust your watering schedule to accommodate to prevent the soil from staying too wet. The larger soil volume means the plants will stay moist longer between waterings. Check the moisture level several inches into the soil using your finger or a moisture meter before watering. When you do water, water thoroughly, allowing any excess water to drain out the bottom of the pot into a saucer. Discard the water in the saucer. Do not let your plants sit in water for more than a few hours. Thank you for joining us for Colorado Gardener. Read by Christy McGowan.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.